Chapter 28 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 28. Dear old Dick Luckman, later the original scout of the Daily Express, was at that time racing correspondent to the Paris New York Herald, owned by the American millionaire Gordon Bennett. He and I were great pals and used to meet regularly at all the meetings round Paris. When my horse Hardy won at Maison Lafitte, paying 68-1 in the Paris Mutuel, Dick Luckman had a good enough win, as he was never tired of recalling in after years, to get his whole family, consisting of his wife and three children, out of pawn, as he expressed it. He had been with them at Dieppe, and as he was going very badly just then, by no means an uncommon experience with him, or with any racing man for that matter, he was quite unable to settle up the hotel bill, which had been running on for many weeks. He had particularly noticed, as I ought to have done myself, that just before Hardy won the race I have alluded to, Le Prix de Lascaux, he had run in a similar handicap on the same course, meeting a similar class of horses, and had put up a fine performance, looking very like winning the race 200 yards from home, but being caught at that point and finishing about fifth in a big field. On this form, coming on the top of his fine performance at Baden, and noticing that the horse was looking extraordinarily well, and being, as he told me afterwards, pretty well desperate, he put all the money he had left in his pocket on Hardy to win and a place. The money he had in his pocket, which was also at that time all the money he had in the world, though of course he had his salary from the New York Herald to come in later, amounted to only a few louis. But such as it was, it brought him in enough to pay up the Dieppe bill and release his family, whom he had left behind in pawn, and also to give him a handsome sum to go on with. Dick Luckman was my constant companion at Deauville, or rather I should say at Trouville, where I was staying at the Roche Noir. He dined with me one night at the casino with two Americans from New York, with whom we had made friends, a Mr. Jennings and his very pretty wife. After dinner I went into the more select of the two clubs, where the big gamblers were, though I doubt if the play, except at one table, was as high as it is now, from what I hear. I took 100 louis bank at baccarat, the fair Mrs. Jennings cut for me, and I ran my bank into rather more than £1,000. We went out and celebrated in a convivial supper. The sequel is sad to relate, for I regret to say that I went after supper into the other club, where I fully believe they got up a game for me, took a bank, and lost the whole of my £1,000, as well as a bit more besides. The next day I bitterly reproached Dick for not having seized the money that I had won, and refused to give it me back till the following day. But, as he pointed out, this was easier said than done, for I was obstinately determined to go on gambling, though he did his best to try to persuade me to stop. I have related here the few occasions that stand out in my memory when I won substantial sums of money, but in truth I was at this time betting in the most idiotic way, and losing large sums of money on balance. From a financial point of view, my French racing career was disastrous, though it is some satisfaction to be able to say that I am still well up on the casino at Monte Carlo, for after I got away with that £1,600, as described in my last chapter, I did not go back there for more than 10 years, when I remained there a week and lost £200. Since then, my gambling days being finished, I have neither lost nor won there more than a few thousand francs, which at the present rate of exchange is not worth mentioning. While I am about it, I may relate another sad story which belongs to this period. On the same day on which, by the disqualification of Fourier, as already described, I was landed with a loss of 500 louis in place of a win of 2,500 louis, dear old Parfremont, the trainer, father of the well-known jockey who rode Le Tour d'Eux to victory in the Grand National some years later, came up to me in the paddock and told me that he had a horse running in the maiden 3-year-old hurdle race on the last day of the Deauville meeting. This was a hurdle race for 3-year-old horses that had never run. He told me his horse was sure to win this race, for which there was a huge field, that he had at least a stone in hand, and that I could get any price I liked about it. He asked me to buy the horse for 10,000 francs, £400, and run it in my name, back it, and win a small fortune. At the time when he spoke to me, I was worried to death. I had just received a telegram from Woodhouse at Baden-Baden that Hardy had been beaten by a short head in the Oos Handicap, and two horses of my own that I brought with me to run at Deauville had both gone wrong, owing to the neglect of a man who had been engaged by Woodhouse to look after them in his absence. This man, an ex-steeplechase jockey, who at one time had been a crack rider, had gone off on a drunken bust, and had left my horses to look after themselves, with the result that they were in a hopeless state, and had not been taken out to exercise for 2 days. I found this out only by chance from one of the stable lads, and I had, of course, immediately sacked the ex-steeplechase jockey, whose name I will not mention. The Fourier incident, coming on the top of all this, had reduced me to a state of deep depression and irritability. I was fool enough to think that Parfrimont was trying to plant me with a horse he wanted to get rid of. I told him that I could not dream of buying the horse, that I had had a frightfully bad week and was losing a lot of money, and that in fact I would have to rush back to London to arrange an overdraft with my bank to meet my bets. I said, "I couldn't give you £40 for a horse, let alone £400. Parfrimont replied by saying that it did not matter a bit about the money. "Take the horse, pay me when you like, and put me 50 louis on it. Put a few hundred on for yourself, and we shall all be in clover." I can hardly bear to write this story now. It really seems to me that I must have been mad not to do what he suggested. I knew him for a splendid fellow. I knew he liked me and was as straight as a die, and anyone who knows anything about racing can easily believe that a man in his position, a small trainer who had been at that time out of form for some time, might be just in the condition of having a really good thing and not a penny to back it with. I had unlimited credit in the ring, and I had plenty of money still available at home, and yet I absolutely refused to do what he asked me to do. I could have easily backed the horse to win £10,000, but I did not even have a penny on. The fact is, I disbelieved his story, and thought he was trying to sell me a horse he did not want. The horse, starting at 50-1, won the race by about 20 lengths, after being in front, right out by himself, the whole way, in a field of about 25 runners. Almost the worst part of the whole thing is that dear old Parfrimont was bitterly offended, as he had every right to be, and would hardly speak to me again. Evidently Providence was determined to get me out of the racing business, for over and over again I missed big things by perverse luck, or, as in this case, by stupidity and bad judgment. I missed getting a horse called Grattan in a claiming race by 500 francs. A claiming race is, or was, peculiar to France. The principle is the same as that of a selling race, only instead of the horse being sold by auction, you write on a piece of paper how much you will give for the horse, and put it blind into a box, which is opened after the race. The highest offer on paper takes the horse. Woodhouse told me that Grattan was, to his certain knowledge, a really good horse, and that I ought to buy him. He was in a claiming race, entered to be sold for about 6,000 francs, as up till then he had done nothing. I asked Woodhouse how much would get him, and he said that 8,000 francs would do it easily, as he did not think that there was anyone after the horse. I determined to make sure, so I wrote 9,000 francs for Grattan on a piece of paper, signed it, and put it in the box. Grattan won the race, for which I had backed him to win enough to cover the cost of my claim. The box was opened, and it was found that the horse had been secured by a well-known Parisian demi-mondaine, Madame Ricotti, for 9,500 francs. This horse subsequently won the big steeplechase, Le Grand Steeple, at Auteuil, worth nearly £5,000. He won half a dozen other big races, and was in fact a real smasher, and worth many thousand pounds. If I had put in another 20 guineas, I would have got him. That, of course, was sheer bad luck, as I would just as soon have made my bid 10,000 or 12,000 francs if Woodhouse had named that price. This concludes the account of my short racing career in France. Although I lost a lot of money and acted very foolishly, as with my little bit of money I had no right to be dabbling in racehorses, I have never greatly regretted it. The 18 months or 2 years during which I had the horses were the happiest days of my life. After all the misery and beastliness of the Oscar Wilde affair, it was a grand thing to get back to the clean, wholesome atmosphere of my entirely sporting little racing stable. Getting up for 2 hours before breakfast to ride glorious gallops in the splendid morning air made me so fit and well that I renewed my youth like the phoenix. The sort of life I'd been living in London, Naples and Paris was very unhealthy. Up till the time when I bought the horses, I had not been on a horse's back, fired off a gun, or played a strenuous game of any kind for at least 6 years. Oscar Wilde, who, during those years, even when I was not actually in his company, completely overshadowed my life, hated sport and games of all kinds. He had no patience with my love of horses and racing. Harris relates, in his Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, how he sneered at Bosie's ridiculous horses, about which he understands nothing at all. I don't profess to give the exact words, but that was the effect of it. He resented my spending money on racing instead of giving it to him. I, for my part, have always had the two distinct sides to my nature. I love literature and poetry and art and music with a passionate love, but I'm equally fond of sport. If I had my life to live again, I might even go in more for sport and less for literature. Even now I am not quite sure that I would not rather have ridden the winner of the Grand National than have done anything else. Anyhow, I believe that my 18 months, on and off, at Chantilly, added 20 years of health and vigour to my life, while my trainer, Woodhouse, whom I always regarded and treated as a personal friend, was one of the best and most loyal natures I've ever come across. At about the same time, I began to get fond of shooting again, and at the time when Oscar Wilde died, I was in the Highlands of Scotland, where I had taken a small winter shooting. His death was a terrible blow to me. I arrived too late to see him alive, a fact for which Ross is solely to blame, for he wrote to me, at Oscar's request, and told me that he was ill, but that it was nothing serious, and 2 days later telegraphed that he was dead. If I had had any inkling of the seriousness of his state of health, I would have rushed over to Paris at once, and if I had seen him before he died, and while he was still conscious, the whole course of future events would surely have been altered. For one thing, Ross would not have been able to appropriate my letters as he did, and for another thing, it is possible that Oscar would have said something about his letter to me, the De Profundis manuscript, supposing that he really knew, as Ross would have us believe, that Ross had the original manuscript in his possession. At any rate, Ross would not have dared to touch any of the letters and manuscripts without my consent. As it was, he told me when I arrived that he had been through Oscar's papers and found nothing of the slightest importance, but he was careful to ask me what I wished done about them. It was not disputed at that time by anyone that I was the person to decide such questions, any more than it was questioned that I should be the chief mourner at the funeral and pay all the expenses. I told Ross to do what he thought best about the papers, and I never bothered my head any more about them. The base use to which he put my letters, of which he thus obtained possession, has already been related. When I reached Paris, poor Oscar had been dead 2 days, and was already in his nailed-up coffin. Robert Ross and Reggie Turner, who were both with him when he died, gave me an account of the last days of his illness. Ross said not a word to bear out the horrible story of his end, which is related in Harris's disgusting book, on the authority of Ross. Reggie Turner has categorically denied the story, and declares that Oscar died quite quietly and peacefully. I have no doubt that Ross's story, with its revolting details, is a pure lie, though what can have induced him to invent such a story about the man he professes to have loved so much must always remain a mystery. Oscar was buried according to the rites of the Catholic Church, in the cemetery at Bagneux, after a requiem mass in the beautiful old church of Saint-Germain-le-Prés. I took the part of chief mourner at the funeral, and was in consequence taken by some of those who were present for his son, or some other near relative. Someone, a lady, asked Ross, as he afterwards told me, who the youth who acted as chief mourner was, and Ross told her that it was Lord Alfred Douglas, whereupon she said, "But the one I mean was a mere boy. It couldn't be Lord Alfred Douglas, who must be about 30." There were several persons at the funeral who were unknown to Ross and Turner and myself, including this lady and two others. One of them I afterwards discovered was a friend, or protégé, of my grandmother, the Honourable Mrs. Alfred Montgomery, who, being a Catholic, and knowing of my connection with Wilde, as of course all the world did, came to pray for him. She wrote to me and told me this afterwards, but I cannot recall her name. I have no personal knowledge about the facts of the removal of Oscar's body from the cemetery at Bagneux to Père Lachaise, which took place many years later under the direction of Ross. End of chapter 28.